Today, China Law and Policy concludes its interview series for the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen Massacre. Today, we are joined with Andrea Warden. Andrea is a noted China expert, human rights advocate, and she will be teaching a course on human rights in China at Johns Hopkins University this fall. But back in the spring of 1989, she was an English teacher at Hunan Medical University in Changsha, China, and as a result, experienced firsthand the student protests that were happening in Changsha and then the subsequent crackdown. Andrea has written about her experience, first as a chapter in a book containing accounts of some of the pro-democracy protests outside of Beijing, and then 15 years later for China Rights Forum. Today, she's going to talk to us about some of her experiences there. So, Andrea, just to start, what started the protest in Beijing, for the Beijing students, it was the death of Hu Yaobang back in, I believe, April of 1989, and that kicked off a lot of the pro-democracy protests there. For your students in Changsha, what were their reactions to Hu's death, or did something else cause them to start protesting?
Well, first, Elizabeth, it is great to be with you again on this, in the run-up to the anniversary of June 4, and I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me about this incredibly important event. I wanted to mention that, just first off, something that is not particularly well-known is the fact that in more than 340 cities in China during the spring of 1989, there were protests, and likely that number is much higher. Mm-hmm. That figure comes from the compiler of the Tiananmen Papers. There I recently saw a figure online with, unfortunately, without a site. It was the wiki on the Tiananmen protests that mentioned the number 400. Mm-hmm. But my own feeling is that it's probably even more than that, because some of my students in Changsha were from fairly small towns in Hunan. When they went home during this protest, during this period of sort of April, May, and May of 1989, they said even in their very small hometowns, villages even, there were protests. So mm-hmm. So it was truly nationwide, and unfortunately, we probably will never know the full scope of the pro-democracy protests in China. So April 15 was the day that Hu Yaobang passed away. We know that that was obviously basically a critical moment in Beijing, and that's what launched the student protests in Beijing. And also in Changsha, many people were very sad when they heard the news. Hu Yaobang actually is from Hunan.
Ah,
right. So okay. There was this sense of like, oh, here's our native son, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. who was viewed very much by many people as being sort of a hero and somebody that they really had hope for, as somebody who supported intellectuals, who supported the students, very much obviously was very much involved in the economic reforms and some political reform under Deng. My particular school, so Hunan Medical University, medical students, they have a reputation for not being particularly political, but there were a few universities on the sort of the other side of a river that goes right through Changsha that were known to be very active politically, both in the earlier 1979, 1980, sort of, and there was also an election movement during that time period. At those colleges. Those colleges include Hunan University, South Central Industrial University, and Hunan Teachers College, or then it was also known as Hunan Normal University. Mm-hmm. So over on that side of the river, the other side of the river, there were sort of mourning activities or events, but no major protest, as far as I know, mm-hmm. yet.
Mm-hmm. And so when your students in Changsha at the Hunan Medical University, mm-hmm. when they started seeing the students in Beijing protest at Tiananmen Square, what were their reactions to it? Did they talk to you about it? Did they feel like they could talk to you about it?
a few of my students that I had become quite close to as good friends, they felt very comfortable mm-hmm. speaking with me about it. They were excited. They were sort of amazed. And there was really this sense of hope that students could come together on such a massive scale and sort of speak out the things that they also very much felt. Mm-hmm. So those things ranged from inflation, which was really a huge problem then at that time. My students felt it personally when the prices at the cafeteria went up, like doubled. Mm-hmm. Some of them said, you know, my parents can't afford this,
right?
And so there was that sort of on a very personal, practical level. But then also corruption was everywhere. That became a big theme of the movement, both in Beijing and in Changsha. So corruption, inflation, and then certainly freedom, democracy. Regardless of what they might have viewed democracy as being, or how they might define it, my clear sense was this, a lot of this was about personal freedoms, more mm-hmm. personal freedom, mm-hmm. more certainly freedom of speech, freedom of expression.
And so in Changsha itself, when mm-hmm. did like the protests really take off? I mean, I guess more for, because you mentioned that they were two different areas of universities and you were in the area on the other side of the river with Hunan Medical University.
Right.
When did your students start participating in the protests?
Sure.
Or most of the university students at Hunan Medical start participating?
Right. So the students on the other side of the river, the more politically active side of town, they had organized demonstrations. I think we could say a smaller-ish demonstration or just gathering on April 15th, mm-hmm. I mentioned,
truly
mourning this leader. And, of course, in China, mourning a leader that has passed invariably ends up commenting on the current leadership,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, just
mm-hmm.
even implicitly. So that was happening. The other folks, the more active folks, organized demonstrations for April 22nd, April 26th, and May 4th. I should say also, I don't have complete information.
So
there may well have been more than this. This is what I have, I have noted, and I've written in my article that you mentioned. So at this point, still, my students were definitely, I think, interested, watching. Some, I'm sure, went out to maybe peek and take a look. But the students, the Hunan Medical University students, were not yet actively involved.
Okay.
En masse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And did they ever become involved en masse?
Yes, they did. Yeah, so let me tell you a little bit about that. It was this sort of, they were watching things very, very carefully. They were able to get information from the VOA and the BBC over, as I put
it, a shortwave radio.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, and so Voice of America and the BBC from England, they were able to get that over shortwave radio, and so what would happen? Of course, not everybody had a shortwave radio, but the people who did would write out on large poster board or pieces of paper. They would write out news from Beijing, and so that and they plaster these large pieces of paper like sort of all over the city or in Maine, or should say Maine area, certainly. At all universities and in big intersections, people were watching, were looking around. Also, there were there were hints at the evening news, a dialogue with the students in Beijing was coming up.
Right.
This was also, of course, televised. And at any rate, so there was that. And there were also, of course, at this point, too, there is something called Chuanlian, which is students networking or people networking across cities, across boundaries, across the country to try to mobilize other students as well as workers. This was a term, I think, that came out from the Cultural Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Really, some of the Changsha student leaders were going up to Beijing. So mm-hmm. so they were, and they're bringing back information. So there's, and then, so basically what happened at my school again, probably one of the last schools to get very involved, was one room of the male students from my class. They decided to fast, to hunger strike or fast on one of the days the students had started their hunger strike in Beijing on May 13. And this really moved people. I mean, so they were inspired and moved by the students who were hunger striking in Beijing, and they said, you know, we had to do something. We mm-hmm. couldn't just sit here and go to class and not do anything, right? So so on May 17, one group of this one room and these young students put a sign up on their door and they said that they would just fast for one day, and they weren't encouraging anybody else to do anything.
Okay.
That this was just something these however many boys, I can't remember, 6, 8, had decided they were going to do as a group. So that also inspired so many people at Hunan Medical University. So when some of the girls in our class found out what the boys were doing, they thought, oh, well, we have to support this too. So it kind of went room by room, mm-hmm. or dorm room by dorm room. So the girls got involved, and then other students from other classes heard what was happening, because word travels fast, you know. And so basically very soon there was a lot of sort of hubbub and momentum. People were fasting for the day, wanting to show support for the students in Beijing. And I wanted to share this story in part because it shows how important one person, or here, seven people deciding to do one thing, this personal act of protest, how that can just totally, truly spark a much larger movement or event or action, because it has a sort of amazing kind of ripple effect of just mm-hmm. of just inspiring other people to take action. So that evening, the student union leaders got onto the loudspeaker, announced over the loudspeaker that the Hunan Medical University was going to participate in the citywide demonstration that was going to be held that night. So it was, and I don't think that was just a coincidence. I mean, it might have been.
Right, anyway, yeah. Right. But yeah. So like at Hunan Medical University, like once this started around May 17th, the hunger strikes, and then the student union leaders announcing that they were going to participate, that the university was going to participate, what happened with classes? Like did they kind of just stop?
Yeah,
or
so
did people did students like try to balance classes? Or
right.
Was it...
So that's a really good question. And they were like on and off.
Okay.
My recollection of this whole period was not a whole lot was happening in terms of classes. I think there was some coursework happening. I recall my students were feeling very stressed about missing classes. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were very obviously concerned about their grades, but they certainly also wanted to participate. So there were some classes were being held on certain days, but there were other times when it just basically it was like every day seemed to be it was either like a demonstration, right? There were class boycotts, there were hunger strikes, there were sit-ins. Also, there started to become some workers' strikes as well, mm-hmm. and then some students just went home.
In the reaction of the female students,
yes.
So I know in your essay "Despair and Hope: A Changsha Chronicle," you actually do discuss. About how the 1989 protest and the movement that was catching mm-hmm. the nation was actually in some ways empowering to female students to engage in the protest. Can you talk maybe a little bit more about that?
Sure.
And put it in a little bit more of a context?
Right. So the students... Changsha came alive during this period of time. So roughly, let's say early May or mid-May through June 4. And it was incredible to witness that. There had been such a feeling of hopelessness beforehand, and also this feeling of just total boredom and depression, mm-hmm. That people felt like they had no one student... had said, I thought I was going to go to college and leaving my parents. I was excited about more freedom. And he said, when I got to Hunan Medical University, it was like I was in prison. So they had so many rules. They were so tightly controlled. And they had to sort of watch every step that they took and just had to you know, just be very, very careful. And they just felt truly oppressed or suppressed. They couldn't really express their individuality. Mm-hmm. It was a time of a lot of conformity. Like you had to say the right thing. You had to act a certain way. And I think students kind of particularly maybe enjoyed our English, not just mine, but also my fellow English teachers, our classes, because we were sort of like, okay, you can come to English class. You can say whatever. You know, we encourage them, obviously, to say what they, you know, how they felt and, you know, write essays about kind of interesting topics. I think they also felt that they could say more in English than they could in their Chinese classes in terms of maybe possibly, quote unquote, sensitive issues. And they were still kind of watching because, you know, they had to still be careful. They were watching sort of what they were saying. But it was a breath of fresh air, our classes. And I think that they didn't have much of that elsewhere. So that period when the demonstrations had started, when people were sort of, you know, writing these wall posters, when they were out and about looking at, you know, watching the demonstrations or just talking among themselves, the students were talking among themselves, like, what's happening? What's happening in Beijing? Where is this going? Or analyzing what was happening at, on the political level. Clearly, there was a split that was coming to the fore between Li Peng and the hardliners and Zhao Ziyang. So people were very busy talking about that, analyzing this. Where was it going to go? What was happening? They were talking also about dynamics between the school, among the schools in Changsha. So it was just this heady time. So basically, everyone, I think, many people felt they had now the space and the freedom to speak out. So including women, right? So that was fantastic to see. I mean, both. Because it just, they look so alive, they look so engaged and happy and sort of free, they really free. Right. Anyway, both the men and the women, so the female and male students. But I think it was interesting because the male students would kind of be quite surprised, and sometimes I was too, when they would see one of their female classmates who had been perhaps quite, you know, maybe fairly demure, shy, didn't seem to be thinking about much of anything, making speeches on the corner, on a street corner in Changsha, about, you know, about large ideas and large principles of freedom, transparency, accountability, democracy. You know, what do we do about corruption? You know, just talking. And yeah. I think so. In that respect, I think everybody felt empowered.
Right.
And it was wonderful. It was inspiring to see. And it was also, I think they all inspired each other. And I think just people took a particular sort of pleasure at seeing the female students step up into that role.
Mm-hmm. And then, on May 20th, 1989, martial law was declared.
Right.
What was the reaction in Changsha?
I also should back up a little bit. April 26th was the day that the People's Daily issued this editorial that declared the Beijing protests, what was happening in Tiananmen Square, declared it to be turmoil. So, dongluan. And that these sort of naive, they didn't use the word, I don't know, the word naive was not used, but that students were being taken advantage of by a small handful of people who were out to, who were anti-party, who were anti-socialist, very hard line. They didn't acknowledge the students' patriotism, which was very much front and center in Beijing and also Changsha. People were very, very clear that they loved their country, they loved China. They were unhappy about the political system. They were very unhappy about corruption, and they were looking for change and more freedoms. So that editorial, just like in Beijing, caused a huge reaction, and so more protests. In terms of May 20, Changsha, the people in Changsha was reacting to what was happening in Beijing,
right?
And so when martial law was declared. It was the night of May 19, but actually it was supposed to take effect May 20. People were very upset, very despondent. They felt like, okay, this is done. It was despair. It was like, our country is going to mobilize the army against us, against the people, against the students. And so it was horrible. They felt betrayed.
And when martial law was declared, how did you feel? Were you scared?
Right. I sort of felt similarly to my students. I had noted in my article, so they felt, there was this feeling of like, how can our government be so cruel? This alternation, this sort of alternation between feeling hopeful and feeling disempowered, and just feeling despair. I was just like, I couldn't believe it. So I was also just felt absolutely, also felt just depressed and just thinking, oh, this is not going to end well. But I wasn't actually scared in Changsha. And also it became clear pretty quickly that troops were not going to sort of proceed into the sort of inner city of Beijing or towards Tiananmen. They were sort of stuck on the outside of the suburbs, and that there was so much popular support.
Mm-hmm.
Once the students in Beijing went back out on the streets after May 20,
mm-hmm.
or maybe that was even, was that the night of May 20? Anyway, they went back after this was declared because they saw that the people were essentially on their side.
Right.
And so when that happened, there was this another
wave of hope.
And like, oh, okay. Like there is a possible hopeful outcome for all this. Mm-hmm.
And then did the students in Changsha continue to protest when they saw the Beijing students?
They did. Yes, they absolutely did. That news from Beijing about just essentially the people of the city stopping the advancement of the troops definitely brought gave the people of Changsha and the students in Changsha a renewed sense of hope. Yes, mm-hmm. And so they continued to protest in various ways. Yep.
And mm-hmm. then so the night of June 3rd into the morning of June 4th is the massacre at Tiananmen Square. So the massacre,
yes,
around Tiananmen Square,
right.
That occurred the night of June 3rd into the morning of June 4th.
Right.
How did you learn about it?
So I learned about I learned about it from my students, actually.
Okay.
So they had gotten up earlier than me on Sunday morning. So that was a Sunday morning, June 4.
Mm-hmm.
And a handful of them came running over to our, the Yale China house, where the teachers were, and sort of were yelling to us from outside,
mm-hmm.
and just to say what had happened. You know, and they, again, had heard from not only, I guess at this point, not only VOA, but also the government was starting to spin this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, and actually one other thing I wanted to say that was also actually incredibly hopeful. There was like a 3-week period in May where the newspapers, the journalists really probably throughout China were actually reporting the real news, which was incredible, including in Changsha. So the Changsha Evening News, which is something I would read, they were reporting what was happening in Beijing, like actual real news, because there was sort of this opening.
Ostensibly, the newspaper would still be government controlled,
right,
but were still writing the truth.
They were right, because they were journalists protesting on Tiananmen Square. So they got involved. And also Shanghai, there were large journalist protests. So that there, that's a whole other piece of the story that's fascinating. But anyway, the morning of June 4, people were just incredibly upset, everybody. Some people were showing it more vividly, they were manifesting their emotions in a sort of more visible way than others. But we were just, I remember just personally just being floored, amazed, just sort of incredibly depressed, and also really felt for my students, who they were very upset about the news. And we also just kind of couldn't believe it. It's just unbelievable, right? You know, the People's Liberation Army opening fire on unarmed protesters,
mm-hmm.
Peaceful protesters. So that was right. So that is a vivid memory of learning about that from my students that morning. And then after that, so June 4 later in the day, and then June 5, and probably even into June 6, there were into June 6, there were protests against the military suppression.
In Changsha,
right.
Okay.
And there were protests. Also, again, this is another part of the untold story. There are many, many untold stories of April 15 to June 6, 7, 1989. And this is one of them. There were many, many, many cities throughout China where residents and residents, workers, students were protesting against the violence in Beijing.
So after the Tiananmen massacre,
yes,
on June 4th,
right,
other cities, including Changsha, continued to protest, even though they knew full well that there was a possibility their army could,
yes,
open fire.
Yes,
on them.
Right. So we know, so Louisa Lim has done a very nice job in her,
right,
book, the People's Republic of Indonesia, telling the Chengdu, what she could find out about the Chengdu story.
Mm-hmm.
And she, there, you know, still she's like, there's much we don't know, but mm-hmm, she does a great job laying out what she's been able to, you know, to discover. And I think also from other things that I've read, it's clear that the mobilization at that time of the military, June 3, 4, very likely was a call across the country to all major cities, because basically in Changsha there was a room, you know, people kept saying there's a rumor that troops are, mm-hmm, right outside the city,
right outside,
and they're going to come in at any time. And if you read other accounts in the book that you mentioned, the pro-democracy protests in China, reports from the provinces, I think many of the other reports from the provinces, same thing. Oh, people were hearing that the troops were like right outside the city, ready to, you know, sort of ready to kind of come into the city and suppress protests as necessary. So there was basically a nationwide mobilization. So people were kind of scared about that. I was, that's one moment where I was definitely feeling a bit scared,
right, right,
because there was clearly an anti-Western turn, particularly anti-American turn at this,
mm-hmm,
point. I mean, not among students or friends and faculty, but just overall politically, like,
right,
in the,
right,
in the sort of the, in the, at the, you know, the CCCP, the party secretary at the school, and in Changsha, like, it was like, Americans are behind this. Fang Lijie was in the, you know, taking,
mm-hmm,
refuge in the embassy,
mm-hmm,
with his wife, and so this was all unfortunate, because we then, the American teachers were very concerned that we were going to become targets. What was interesting about that time was that these protests also were sort of, in a way, became a bit more radical in. They basically were causing, they caused, you know, it wasn't just the workers, it was students, it was workers, it was residents. Many people were involved in blocking the train tracks, so no trains could move.
Okay.
Yeah, right. So the whole,
yeah,
railroad operation was a,
yeah,
standstill, also blocking major intersections. So they would corral whatever, buses and trucks. I mean, it was anarchy, but it,
yeah,
was peaceful anarchy,
okay,
in a way. It was like, no, it was these were actions that the Changsha populace supported in a way. That then just, there was debris, you know, in the streets. I remember the ride out to the airport. We just passed all, you know, the driver was trying to figure out how to get around all these roadblocks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we just saw a lot of sort of detritus in the streets. And I'm not sure if I answered your question, but yeah, so they went on for a couple of days. There was also a sense of like, who's really in control? So,
yeah.
So that was this also, again, fascinating feeling of, this is so incredibly unusual.
So, yeah, your experience in the spring of 1989 in Changsha,
mm-hmm,
what impact did it have on you?
Right. So this was, it was an incredible moment, incredible time, and it was very dramatic. So our exit, our leaving, so we left very abruptly. It was really evacuation. Yale China essentially said, you know, we're sending, you know, there'll be a plane and you are getting on it, and,
mm-hmm,
you are coming back. Our parents were, of course, also like, get out of there.
Yeah.
So, and as we were leaving, many people said, we don't know what's going to happen, and you have to tell the world what happened here in Changsha, because people knew that they wouldn't then be able to write about it or talk about it or even develop their photographs. I was thinking about this recently. So when I was out on, you know, watching the protest and sort of taking photographs and documenting, just noting down like some of the wall posters, some of the slogans, everyone had a camera, or so many people had cameras and were taking photos. Mm-hmm. Where did all those? After June 4,
right.
No people could not get that film developed.
Yeah.
So where did all that go? So there's all this sense of like this missing history. And I think people also realizing they were not going to be able to tell their story. I think they were very proud that they came out to support Beijing, to support the students and the workers. So the Changsha workers also got very involved in all of this, which of course made everybody in the government party folks the most nervous. And they felt really proud. This was because this was such an empowering moment for them. And they were like, you know, we did something here.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't succeed in the end. We want the world to know. We want people to know. So I did feel this sense of like, wow, returning to the U.S., I had this new sense of feeling very appreciative of the freedoms we have here and the rights that we have here, and that the absence of these rights and freedoms were just so apparent immediately once it was clear that that the hardliners had won this battle, that people wouldn't be able to talk about this, that they didn't, again, they had to toe the party line. My students told me that they had 2 weeks of mandatory political education,
mm-hmm.
In the fall of, I think it was, yeah, in fall or maybe in the summer, or later in summer. Some of them said it was horrible. Some of them totally bought the party line. So I felt very much like I wanted to do something to help support the democracy movement in China, because it wasn't going away. I mean, these feelings were. And these desires, these wants were felt widely in China. And I wanted to do what I could with the freedoms that I have to support their efforts.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got back, I was starting a PhD program in Chinese history at Stanford, but I was quite involved in human rights in China. I think it was just starting to get going. The organization Human Rights in China, doing what I could to help also try to tell the story, to help put the book together, Children of the Dragon, for Human Rights in China. And so have been involved on and off in various ways over the years, mm-hmm. in this cause. And it's basically taken on different forms and shapes over the years.
And what do you think ultimately is the legacy of the Tiananmen Massacre?
Right. So there are a few different answers to that. And I think it's an important question. One aspect of the legacy, or one legacy, is very much what did the Communist Party learn from this? Deng Xiaoping early on said that, and this is all, it's in the Tiananmen Papers, and it's in Zhao Ziyang's, the quote-unquote secret journal, The Prisoner of the State, mm-hmm. The transcription of his audio tapes, that Deng felt that they had been too lax with ideological work. So early on in 86, there had been student protests then, followed by the anti-bourgeois liberalization campaign and the anti-spiritual pollution campaign. That's right when I arrived in China. I was a little bit nervous about that. But they were like, they were like, oh, don't worry about it. I was in Tianjin. I spent the first 6 months in Tianjin. And the teachers and the folks that I interacted with in Tianjin were like, oh, don't worry. Like, I see signs up everywhere about anti-this, anti-that, essentially, you know, anti-Western kind of everything. And they were like, oh, well, no, you're so welcome here. Don't worry. Don't pay attention to any of that. We're not paying attention to it. So basically, Deng was like, this is because, you know, lacks ideological work, right? So we see now, 30 years later, Xi Jinping, there, you cannot say that he's lax,
yeah.
right? That the CCP, he's anything but lax, right? So, over the years since 1989, that we've seen, I mean, there have been moments that seemed, you know, they were a bit more open, but the overall trend has been not lax. So, and control on information, of course, censorship, as the internet grew, of course, you know, media censorship. And so not lax, all right? So there's that aspect of essentially political education, indoctrination, ideological education, and right. So we see that now, you know, tenfold, a hundredfold in Xinjiang, what's happening with the Uyghurs, right? Forced. So they're in concentration camps, probably 1.5 million, you know, all told. And very much of this is about political education, forced education, right, among other things, right? So forced ideological education. So one aspect is this, that we have to sort of control information, control thought. But there's also just the physical... The sort of physicality, if you will, of the protests. I mean, now it's like physically impossible, mm-hmm, with all of the surveillance cameras and everything. They want to prevent you from even having the thought of protesting. That's what a lot of the ideological education is about. And also, of course, everything is watched and surveilled, and right. So you can't even mobilize people, like five people, to kind of, or it's very difficult to mobilize even like 5 or 10 people to do anything,
right?
So nobody is going to. It's extremely hard to imagine a scenario where people are back on Tiananmen Square. Mm-hmm. So there, and also, of course, another lesson was we need to train our, you know, people's armed police, our force. We need to be able to also have trained police, quasi-military forces, whatever, to deal with anything that might happen, to deal with protests, like, and essentially riot police, if you will. So they've got that whole aspect of things totally also nailed down. Obviously, we do see these sort of spontaneous or just very small efforts here, mm-hmm, and there, but they're immediately shut down. Mm-hmm. So I think no more Tiananmens, of course, is a big legacy. No more and no little Tiananmen, you know, or in terms of the protests, mm-hmm, no little, mm-hmm, protests. And then also, of course, in terms of the legacy, this is such a sensitive issue for the Communist Party. The whole period, particularly the massacre and the incredible spin that they put, their, mm-hmm, the story they've told, that they continue now 30 years later to detain people, you know, who might mention June 4, write something, trying to commemorate June 4. One recent example is the four people in Chengdu, I believe, who with the June 4 liquor labels.
Oh, yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
So there was one, I think it was even like one bottle. They went to, they, yeah, then it was like 3 and 4 year, mm-hmm, sentences for that. Mm-hmm. So it's that level of insecurity, of absolute intolerance toward any sort of expression around June 4 and commemorating the dead. Those who were killed, or some have also called for to redesignate those protests as patriotic, mm-hmm, and as not turmoil, something that is, I think, going to continue to be something that people will continue to call for, but the CCP, I can't imagine them really doing that. It would seriously have to be major political reform, mm-hmm, for that to happen. But one day, I'm hopeful, one day, that will indeed happen. And that particularly, I wanted to also just mention the group, the Tiananmen Mothers.
Yes.
Right?
Yes,
so yes. Who have come to family members who lost loved ones in Beijing, June 3 and 4, in 1989, who have just been an amazing, forced to try to uncover, because the Chinese government isn't, and is trying to suppress this information, trying to uncover the names and identities and sort of details about who was killed that night, right? So, and they're still at it. They're calling for an investigation, for compensation, and for an apology. So anyway, it's important to also honor their efforts and their loss.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you and also echo your sentiments that there's still a lot of brave Chinese that are still trying to commemorate what happened on June 4th, mm-hmm, and the bravery of their fellow citizens. Mm-hmm. But I want to also thank you for also writing down your stories and remembering for the Chinese people who can't right now develop their photos of what happened during that time period and commemorate it in the way they can. So thank you again, Andrea, for sharing. And do you have any last words?
Yeah, and thank you so much for although it's such a, it's a grim topic, mm-hmm. if you will. I appreciate the opportunity to sort of share this with you. And I did actually want to end on another note of hope, which is that another legacy of Tiananmen is also those people who continue to fight for democracy and human rights in China. For example, Charter 08, and the Charter 08 movement, Liu Xiaobo and many others, many of the human rights lawyers, there is like sort of a direct line from 1989 through Charter 08 mm-hmm. to today. And so a lot of the activism is happening outside of China now, but there's still activists in China doing what they can in the very limited space that they have to fight for human rights, for rule of law, and for political freedom.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you for reminding us of that.
Okay, thanks, Elizabeth.
Thank you.